For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're in the last section of this book called Hebrews, which focuses on practical application. And you'll find that that's often the way biblical New Testament books work. The first part is explanation of what God's done in His love through Christ, explanation of the gift that He's offering to us, that He already paid for through Christ. And then the last part will be application, how to respond to that gift in a way that changes our lives and the lives of others. And so in Hebrews chapter 12 last week, we just looked at one verse, the first verse, which tells us about some application to what Christ has done for us. And I'm thinking about that part that's underlined there where he says, "Let us run with endurance the race that God has set before us." Here's this athletic metaphor in which the author says that God has entered you and me into a race. He's set a race before us. He's designed a course for us to run. And so last week we talked about what this race is. This is not a race to find God or to get God's acceptance. In fact, this race begins only after you've found God through Christ. And only after, through Christ, you've received God's complete forgiveness. That's the beginning of the race. The beginning of the race is when you realize that God loved you enough to send Christ to die for you, to pay for all of your guilt. And when you say to Him, "I want Christ's death to pay my debt. I want Christ to make me a child of God." Then that one decision permanently gives you God's forgiveness, and it's also the starting gun for this race. Because this race that God sets before us once we receive Christ is a life, His plan for your life. His plan for your life so that your life influences other people for Jesus Christ. So that your life attracts people to the Christ who's changed your life. So that your life influences and encourages people who have met Christ to keep running their race. That's what the race is. And he says this race requires endurance, because unlike becoming a Christian, which just takes one simple decision to receive this gift of forgiveness, the race is a long race. It's the rest of your life until you die or Christ returns. It's like a marathon. And it's like a marathon steeplechase, because the race also, the course is filled with obstacles. And so the author says you'll need endurance to run in this race. And to that end, the author gives us four very practical keys to running this race with endurance. And we looked at the first two of those keys last week. I'll just mention them to you briefly, because we'll now go on to look at the second set of keys to running the race. The first key, he said, is to get rid of the suitcases. It's hard to run a marathon carrying even a briefcase. So he says, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that so easily hinders our progress. And so we'll need to hand over to God the habits and that are harmful to us and that sap God's energy. We talked about that last week. And then he says, secondly, that if you want to run the race with endurance, then you're going to need to get strength from other veteran runners. You can't run this race alone. And so the author, alluding back to chapter 11, which was about all these Old Testament figures that ran their race victoriously, he says, since we're surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses in this life of faith, in other words, drawing on their inspiration, learning from their examples, we can gain strength from them and from veteran runners that God has put in your life. There are people in your life right now who've followed Christ longer than you have, who've already navigated that portion of the course that you're just entering into, who have learned valuable lessons and through whom God is able to motivate and equip you to run your race. So you'll need to get strength from other veteran runners. Now, in verses 2 through 13, the author gives us two more keys to running this race so that our lives can be truly meaningful and so that they can be truly satisfying. And the third key then, well, let me just set the stage for it. I do a little bit of long distance running. I confessed last week I've never run a marathon, but I boasted that I have run half marathons. But then I confessed that I chickened out of running the half marathon last year. But then I'll boast that I ran 15 or 20 miles this week. So anyway, the point is that if you run long distances, then very soon you'll realize that your mental focus is really important. And I find that if I don't attend to my own mental focus, my mental focus naturally goes on to one of three things: how far I still have to go, that pain that I feel somewhere in my body, and on the people that are passing me up. And each of those are debilitating. And if I let myself focus on any of those very long, my mind starts to manufacture ingenious reasons why I really need to stop right now. Okay? And so I have to consciously choose not to let myself focus on those distractions and to focus on something else instead that will help me. And for me, that's why I like to run with other fellow runners, because we can talk. And when we talk about other things, then I don't think about those three bad things, and the run goes faster, it goes by more quickly. I don't know that I go more quickly, but you understand the point. Well, that's the point that the author is making, because he says the third key, he says, let us run the race with endurance, fixing our eyes on Jesus. And this word fixing your eyes means both looking away from things that will distract and debilitate you, and instead focusing on something that will strengthen you as you run. And in this case, he says, it's by fixing our eyes on Jesus, that's what helps us run the race with endurance. Now, when he says that, he's not advocating, visualization therapy, that, you know, you construct in your mind this beautiful picture of Jesus's face with his long flowing brown hair and an earring in his left ear, whatever, you know. And so you just think that face, you put that face in your mind, and that'll help you. That's not what he's talking about. As you'll see, when he says fixing our eyes on Jesus, he's saying to focus on certain things about what Jesus did and what Jesus supplies. And it's as we fix our mental focus on those things that we receive strength to run the race with endurance. And he breaks it down in two ways. He says, first of all, focus your attention on Jesus as the example, the exemplar of race running. When he says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author of faith, that's an unfortunate translation, because the word author here means pioneer, the one who has gone on before you and blazed the trail that you're now running in, the one who has already set the example by running his race ahead of you. And in particular, that's what most of the rest of the verbiage here is about the example that Jesus set in running his race, specifically the example of endurance that he set. He said, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him, and that word means reflect carefully on. Consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself. Why? Why? So that you will not grow weary and lose heart. He's saying that if you know the race that Jesus ran, and he's referring to those last 24 hours, which now, thanks to Mel Gibson's The Passion, we all have a much more vivid, really, and for me, an indelible understanding of what Jesus endured those last 24 hours. The humiliation of being mocked and stripped naked as he was excommunicated from Jewish and Roman society, the pain that he endured through his scourging. Who can ever forget what a scourging means now, having seen that movie, let alone the agony of crucifixion? He says it is helpful when you are feeling tempted to quit because of the pain involved in running your race. It's very strengthening to consider Jesus as your example, because he is not in some celestial palace handing down pious platitudes, run your race. He came down out of that place and lived his life as a human being without taking advantage of any of his divine benefits, and voluntarily subjected himself to this kind of shame and torture. He did it even though at any moment he could have brought this to an end and escaped the pain. You know, there's that fascinating passage, almost as a sidebar, in Matthew chapter 26, when Jesus has just been taken into custody, the initial event of his passion, where he says to his disciples, "Do you not know that I could say the word and my Father would send a whole legion of angelic spirit beings to deliver me from this and put an end to this whole thing?" He said, "And yet all these things must take place." So he voluntarily ran this kind of race, and he ran it because of the joy that he looked forward to of having us eligible to spend eternity with him in God's kingdom. He ran it for our sake because there was no other way by which we could be forgiven by a holy God and be accepted into his kingdom. He says you need to spend time thinking about that when you're being tempted to drop out of the race, because you'll draw strength from his example. Not only, though, he says, his example, but he says, focus your attention on something else about Jesus, namely that he is the perfecter as well as the author. And this, again, is an unfortunate translation. Author means he's the example of running the race. Perfecter means the one who supplies what is lacking in us so that we can keep running the race. So the image here is not only that Jesus stands at the finish line, so to speak, saying, "I've already run the course. Now come where I am," but that he's also running the race with you, step for step, stride for stride. When I ran the half marathon last fall, it was really cool. Every couple miles, you had those Gatorade booths, you know, where they're holding out, they hold the Gatorade for you, and they have those high carb loading gels that they hand out to you, and you can squish them in your mouth. What would it be like if you had someone who was actually running with you stride for stride, who was ready with the Gatorade or the high carb loading gel whenever you needed it? That's the image that's being painted here. That if you focus on him as the example who's already run the race, and if you realize that he is personally present, this is not some mystical thought like a Hallmark greeting card to give you a little warm, fuzzy smile, that he is literally, though invisibly, personally with you and accessible to you every step of your race, ready to supply whatever you need to keep running the race. Remember that, he says. Focus on that. A lot of you know this passage. We call it the Great Commission. You could also call it the Great Race Commission. Because here's Jesus commissioning us to run the race. He says to his disciples, after he finished his race and was raised from the dead, just before he ascended to heaven, he said, go. Now you go. You go and make disciples of all nations. Influence other people for me all over the world. Baptizing them in the name of the Father and Son and the Holy Spirit. In other words, helping them, introducing them to me so that they meet me. And teaching them to obey all that I've commanded you. And then helping people who've met me grow and develop and mature so they can run their race. That's the race. And then he said, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. That he's saying, I will be personally present with you every step of the race to supply you with the guidance that you need as when you become confused about the course of your race, where to go next, to supply you with encouragement as you run into obstacles that are painful and exhausting, to supply you with the power that you need to keep going. It's in this respect that it's helpful for me to realize I don't, you know, being macho really doesn't help you run the race. And there's no such thing as spiritual machismo in the Christian life. It's not about, you know, keeping a stiff upper lip and just like, you know, being so tough that you don't ever admit that anything gets to you. Paul says, you know, I've learned the great secret. I've learned to boast about my weaknesses. He says, because when I'm really aware of my weaknesses and I take them to Christ, then the power of God is supplied to me to keep running the race. I like this passage. In Isaiah 40, where it says, God gives strength to the weary, and he increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and even young men stumble and fall, but those who hope in the Lord, and the meaning here of this Hebrew verb is those who depend upon the Lord, will renew their strength. They'll soar on wings like eagles, they'll run and not grow weary, they will walk and not be faint. Do you know how to look to Christ as the provider of what you need to keep running the race? It's through prayer. It's not any, you know, esoteric technique that you have to pay someone $1,000 to learn. It's just a matter of staying in conscious communion with him and personally throughout the day, alone and with other fellow runners, just turning to him and acknowledging to him the weakness that you have, your confusion, your weariness, your discouragement, choosing to agree with him that he is with you though you cannot see him and that he has all the resources you need, and then just asking him, God, I need some direction at this point in the course. God, I need some encouragement. I need to see that what I'm doing matters. It's through that kind of simple, honest, dependent prayer that you draw upon the provision of the invisible Jesus Christ who is with you every step of the race. And it's the great public secret of lifelong race runners. Are you chronically confused and weary and discouraged? How often are you focusing on him as the provider and communicating with him in this way? That's a very humbling question for me to ask myself. The one thing I'd like to say before we move on is that, you see, a lot of us, we ask Jesus for a lot of things, but we don't get answers often because we're really kind of relating to him as a genie. And we're saying, I've got my course that I've decided I'm going to run, and you're here to help me move down my course. This is when you say, I'm committed to running the course that you have for me. And so I need your wisdom, your guidance, your strength, your encouragement to run the course that you've set for me. He answers that. All right. The fourth and final key. Let me set the stage for it as well. Professional marathoners, something I've never been, never will be. People who are serious about world-class marathoning, they will tell you that if they're gonna compete at that level, then they've got to have a trainer. They have personal trainers. And if you were just an outsider who didn't understand what was going on and you watched that trainer dealing with those world-class marathoners, you might even draw the conclusion that those guys are sadistic. You know what I'm talking about? The key to these trainers is that they've got knowledge. They understand what a marathon requires. And they've studied the kinesiology, all that fancy stuff. They know what it requires from your body. They know your body maybe better than you know your own body if you're a world-class runner. They know your physique. They know your running form. They know precisely where you lack strength in certain muscle groups. They know your heart rate. They know everything about you that's preventing you from running the race the way that you want to run it. And they know how to develop a training regimen. This is where the uncomfortable part comes in. They know how to develop a training regimen that will hammer your body into shape to do what you've decided you really want to do, which is to marathon at a world-class level. And, you know, a lot of what they, really most of what they prescribe in that training is painful. It's painful. And this is the fourth key that the author now introduces to. And I think this is the one that we American Christians have the hardest time with for reasons that I'll explain in just a moment. Is that if you have met Christ, and your purpose is to run the race that God has set before you, then you are going to need a trainer. You are going to need someone who has the knowledge of the race that you don't have, who has the knowledge of what's deficient in you that you don't see, and who has the knowledge of the exact amount of calibrated stress and strain that needs to be placed on your body recurrently so that it can be hammered into shape to run the race that he has set before you. And God the Father in this case, is that trainer. And so if you want to run the race with endurance and complete it victoriously, then you have to cooperate with the trainer. And here's the part that we don't like. The part that we don't like is that his training regimen is painful. It hurts. And we could get into a lengthy theological discussion at this point, which has its place, but today's not the place, you know. But the point is this, that it's through suffering that God, as your trainer, hammers you into shape so that you can run the race that he designed you to run, and that he commissions you to run. And unless you run it, your life won't be fully meaningful or fully satisfying the way that he has designed you. And it's through suffering. And we could talk about how which ones of these sufferings are sufferings that he actually initiates into your life versus which ones are sufferings that he did not initiate but which he mysteriously works through anyway in his training program. The point is, and the author, as you'll see, insists on this, that he is working at all times in the life of every one of his children through all of the sufferings that we experience to train us to run the race. And we have to come to grips with that and agree with him that this kind of training is necessary. I like the way J.I. Packer describes this feature of God's involvement in our lives. This is from his classic book, Knowing God, and it is a classic. You should read it. He says, we should not be too taken aback when unexpected, notice the adjectives, unexpected, upsetting, and discouraging things happen to us now. That is, now that we're in the race. What do they mean? Why, simply that God in his wisdom means to make something of us which we have not attained yet. And he is dealing with us accordingly. This is God as trainer. Perhaps he means to strengthen us in patience or good humor. That means not being so negative, which is my default. Or in compassion, or in humility, or in meekness. Meekness is strength under control, so that your strength is used redemptively in the lives of others rather than to waste people. Or by giving us some extra practice in exercising these graces under specially difficult conditions. You know the prayer, God, make me patient now. Perhaps he has new lessons in self-denial, horrid word to our culture, and self-distrust, blasphemous word to our culture, to teach us. Perhaps he wishes to break us of complacency or spiritual unreality or undetected forms of pride and conceit. Perhaps his purpose is to draw us closer to himself in conscious communion with him, because it is often the case that our fellowship with God is most vivid and most sweet, and that Christian joy is greatest when the cross is heaviest. That's a paradox that you'll never understand unless you've met Christ. But that in the times that are most difficult, when we're cast back on him, that those are the times that we know him best and we experience joy. Or perhaps God is preparing us for forms of service of which we at present have no inkling. Yeah, those are wise words. That's the trainer's agenda. And there's a sense in which God is relentless in his role as trainer in your life. Nothing that you can do when you meet Christ can ever fire God from being your trainer. He will relentlessly pursue a personalized training regimen for you so that you can fulfill his purpose for your life. What you can do is prevent yourself from reaping the benefit of his training by not cooperating. And so that's the whole point of this next passage, is that if you want to run the race with endurance, then you got to cooperate with the trainer. And if you're going to cooperate with the trainer, it's imperative that you trust him. Trust him as the trainer in a couple of key ways. First of all, you've got to choose to trust that his motivation in training you is one of love, not of anger or malice or neglect, no matter how difficult the training may be. He says, you've forgotten the word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. And so now he switches from the race metaphor momentarily to the parent-child metaphor. And then he'll switch back to the race metaphor. My son, this is from Proverbs, don't make light of the Lord's discipline. The word discipline also can be translated training, paiduo, training. Don't make light of the Lord's training. Don't lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves. And he punishes, and the word punish means a discipline that's initiated to correct you. He punishes everyone he accepts as his own son. And so endure hardship as God's discipline. God is treating you as his sons. What son is not disciplined by his father? Different culture, folks. If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, different culture, then you're illegitimate children and not even true sons at all. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. Different culture. How much more should we submit to the Father of our own spirits and live? And the idea live here means to grow healthy and strong and effective. Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best. But God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in His holiness. And holiness is just a word that means that we may share His character, that we may become more like Christ. Now look, folks, we live in a culture. This is so countercultural. This is so counterintuitive, because we now live in a culture that views human beings as so essentially good, that so that we are internally already headed the right way, and so fragile with regard to suffering, that the whole idea of pain that is purposeful and constructively inflicted from without is alien to the way that we think. And yet God, who created you, says that there's a lot of pride and foolishness bound up in your heart and my heart that nothing short of this kind of discipline will drive it out of us, so that we learn humility and so that we learn wisdom. And that what motivates God to play the role of our disciplinarian or our trainer is the great love that He has for us. And so He reminds them of one partial, imperfect paradigm that they had and that you and I have. You know, I think about my own parents. And they disciplined me for a short time as seemed best to them. And they were not perfect. And they didn't always discipline me in the right way. And I remember at the time really being pretty irked with them most of the time about their discipline. You know, they'd do horrible things like make me work if I wanted to spend money and insist upon doing my homework. And they inflicted these sadistic punishments for me when I would lie or deal drugs or, you know, do these other, you know, harmless things. And I remember being envious of friends that I had who were parented by modern parents. They called their parents by their first names, and their parents basically just kind of like were hands-off parents, because my kid's essentially good and they know the way and I just stay out of the way. I used to feel like they had it so good and I had it so bad, but you know, now I know that's not true. And I think about the thankless job that my parents had to train me to live real life, which as an adult, you know, I've reaped the benefits of in certain ways. And I learned industry from them. I learned self-control. I learned that it was possible to say no to my own lusts. And it wasn't long before I looked at my friends who I thought had it so good, and I realized they're wild beasts in human form. And their lives are set on fire because they're not able to say no to themselves. They're not able to defer gratification. So I have that paradigm. You've got it. And some of you, you know, okay, some of you had parents that were usually not this way. They were permissive or absent or even abusive. But you had some figures in your younger life, whether they were a parent or a grandparent or a relative or a teacher or a coach, you had some people in your life who loved you enough to discipline you. And you need to think about that. You need to think about how they did that and the thankless job that it was and how you have benefited from what they did, and then you need to realize that's the position that I'm in now with God. And this is an attitude. People say, well, how do I respond to God's discipline? Give me a list. Mainly it's an attitude. And the first attitude is, because if you have this attitude, then he'll show you how to respond specifically. The first thing is to choose the attitude. You are disciplining me because you love me and it's for my good. How do I know when I've got that attitude? Well, for one thing, I know that I have that attitude when I'm not focusing so much on the circumstance itself or the human agent of my suffering, but where I'm focused instead on God allowed this to happen. I know that I have this attitude when instead of complaining and being embittered toward God about my suffering, I'm even choosing to thank Him, thank you that you know what you're doing, thank you that you love me enough to train me in this way. Now, you don't have to be a 40-year-old Christian to thank God by faith for His discipline. And I know that I have more this attitude when instead of obsessing on questions like, why did you let this happen? He's already told me why, right? Because He's disciplining me because He loves me. Or, how long is this going to go on? Or, how can I get out of this? Instead, to be prayerfully asking, what are you trying to teach me through this? If you want to run the race with endurance, you got to cooperate with the trainer. And if you're going to cooperate with the trainer, you've got to choose based on His track record in your life, based on the fact that He went to the cross for you, that's how much He loves you, to trust that His discipline is motivated by His love. He knows what He's doing. Secondly, we have to trust that the benefit comes later, not now. I think this is a verse that every race runner should memorize. No discipline seems pleasant at the time. Duh. How do you know it's discipline? It hurts. If it doesn't hurt, it's not discipline. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Here's the key phrase. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. So if you want to benefit from the training, you've got to trust that God is training you because He loves you, and you've got to trust that it's really true what they say in the weight room. What's the saying? No pain, no gain. Pain now, gain later. And that applies to the spiritual life as well, that there will be gain. But it comes through and as a result of the pain now. When one of the very few places in our culture that recognizes this principle now is in the world of upper athletics. I don't think we hardly even understand this in any other part of modern life. We are so addicted to comfort now, to instant gratification, to the easiest way to stimulation and comfort immediately, that we have virtually no category for the value of patience. One of the things driving this is information technology. One book of many that I've read on this subject is entitled The End of Patience. Want a stupid example? When's the last time you dialed a number on a rotary phone? You know, I've done studies about the frustration levels that people experience now if they have to dial a 7-digit number on a rotary phone, when in fact it's only just a couple seconds longer than a touch tone. But see, we are so geared. It used to be when I was a kid, man, I'm old. You know, they'd say, let the phone ring 10 times before you hang up. How do you feel after 3 rings if you don't at least get voicemail? You know what I'm talking about? I mean, this sounds stupid, but there's a sense in which it's really insidious because it leaks into the whole way that we approach life. That I'm an American, I deserve for my life to come to me with comfort and ease immediately. And one of the very rare places where we even understand this principle is in high-level athletics. You know, the team that celebrates the national championship in football, you know, is going to be made up of people who not just this past season, but for seasons, have gone out the month after the season's over, and they're in the weight room with burning thighs and biceps. They're out running at dark. They're at the 2-3-a-day practices in the fever heat of summer. And when a lot of other folks dropped out because all they saw was the pain. No pain, no gain. Now that's God's way. And really, you know, he's not going to change his training program. He knows what's inside of me that needs to be worked out. He knows what needs to be corrected. He knows what needs to be shaped. He's going to be utterly faithful in doing that because he loves me. The question is, how much do I want the real benefit? You have to decide as a follower of Christ whether you value the harvest of righteousness and peace. Now he switches to a third metaphor, the metaphor of agriculture. He's just a metaphorical jungle. You have to decide what you want more. You have to decide, do I want this, and I'll explain it in just a minute, more than I want comfort and ease quickly? Because it's going to be one or the other. I mean, look, if you go down this path, it's going to involve allowing God to correct you about your character flaws, and correction is painful. And something, you know, the worst thing about it is that most of the time he decides to correct us through other people that are goofed up like we are. It's really irksome. And it's so easy for me to say, what about you? Look at that booger hanging out of your nose and you're talking to me. It's so easy to justify my sins and blame shift the other. Why go through the pain of that? We've got a whole culture that says that that's going to psychically harm me even if I do admit that I've been wrong. Why go through that over and over and over again? Why not just take the easy way out? Why devote thousands of hours to studying the mind of God and his word so that you learn the way God thinks, so that you can think imperfectly his thoughts and communicate imperfectly his thoughts to other people? Why go through that? It's not super stimulating all the time. Why do that when you can turn on the TV and surf or internet for hours and be mindlessly numbed and entertained? Why learn how to sacrificially serve people? Why follow God into situation after situation where he asks you to give of yourself with nothing in return from the person to whom you gave? So that you can learn what it's like to have your character shaped into that of a servant. When you can opt out of that so easily for comfort in our culture. Why undergo that? Well, those that undergo that do it because they trust this principle. There's a benefit later that makes the pain involved pale in comparison, and which exposes the hollow comfort and entertainmentism of our culture for the shallow, hollow sham that it is. Because it's real life. It's a harvest of righteousness and peace. That means an ever-increasing formation of your character to be like the character of Jesus Christ, so that as other people interact with you, they are being changed by Christ. That's righteousness. And peace is the ever-growing confidence that because the almighty hand of God is on your life, there is literally nothing that anyone or anything can throw at you that he's not going to be able to not only get you through, but use to fashion your life for his high purposes. That's worth it. And I don't stand here before you saying, you know, come look at my granary. It's just bumper crop of righteousness and peace. But I know something of what this is about. I've experienced some of it. And I will tell you that I do not regret cooperating in the imperfect ways that I've cooperated with God as my trainer, because the harvest is worthwhile. What do you want from your life? You want to just get by with as little effort and as little discomfort? Or do you want your life to count for Christ so that you made an eternal difference in the lives of real people that he loved and died for, that he worked through you redemptively in the lives of others? There's a satisfaction that comes from that that's worth the pain. And so James puts it this way. He says, this training program tests your faith and it produces perseverance. Wow, now that's real sexy. Perseverance. Value perseverance. That's the ability to keep going. God values that highly. Whatever else God might be doing through your latest training episode, he's always trying to increase your perseverance, because he says perseverance must finish its work that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing, that you are fully formed and equipped to play the role to run the race that God sent you to run. And Paul in Romans 5 puts it this way. We also can rejoice in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, and perseverance produces character, and character produces hope. So you see the same theme diced in different ways by other biblical authors. Here's how he ends this section. He says, therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and your weak knees. And the idea is cooperate in God's gymnasium. It's him doing the strengthening, but you're cooperating with him. Make level paths for your feet, so that the lame may not be disabled, but rather be healed. There is an intimation in this text that I didn't know about until a year ago, that the lame being healed rather than disabled is probably not you and me, because he just said your limbs are, your arms are weak and your knees are feeble, not lame. He's saying cooperate with God as he trains you to run the race. Set a straight path so that those coming behind you are lame will be healed in part by your impact on them. And we're right back to where we start, that this race is about allowing Christ to impact others for good through you. All right, next week we're going to look at Esau, who comes up next in the passage as the way to not run the race. So that's what next week is, how to not run the race. We need negative examples. They're highly instructive. I don't want to be a negative example. So let's pray. And then I've asked Josh McElhaney to close us.
There's a lot to digest with this teaching, Father. And so first, I just want to hand this over to you and ask you to reveal to me what you want me to learn from this. Mm-hmm. I thank you for just the security of knowing your love is always going to be there, no matter if I'm running the race or crawling or kicking and screaming as you're dragging me. I'm just so grateful, Father, that you supply the strength to keep going, and the brothers and sisters along the way to encourage and to gain courage from. And, I'm just super excited about meeting you one day and saying, well done, good and faithful servant. And right now I'm at the foothills of a large mountain, and it seems to be overwhelming, but you reminded me of this teaching to keep my focus on you, that you gave us Jesus, the perfect example of what faith is, and that we can draw on him for strength. So just give us a point or two here, Lord, to digest and to take home. Amen.
Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.